program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first article today is entitled Atomic War or Peace, and this was written by Albert Einstein for the November 1947 issue of The Atlantic. And this is actually as told to Raymond Swing, who probably did the writing. Since the completion of the first atomic bomb, nothing has been accomplished to make the world more safe from war, while much has been done to increase the destructiveness of war. I am not able to speak from any first-hand knowledge about the development of the atomic bomb, since I do not work in this field. But enough has been said by those who do to indicate that the bomb has been made more effective. Certainly the possibility can be envisaged of building a bomb of far greater size, capable of producing destruction over a larger area. It is also credible that an extensive use could be made of radioactivated gases, which would spread over a wide region, causing heavy loss of life without damage to buildings. I do not believe it is necessary to go on beyond these possibilities to contemplate a vast extension of bacteriological warfare. I am skeptical that this form presents dangers comparable with those of the atomic warfare. Nor do I take into account the danger of starting a chain reaction of a scope great enough to destroy part or all of this planet. I dismiss this on the ground that if it could happen from a man-made atomic explosion, it would have already happened from the action of cosmic rays, which are continually reaching the Earth's surface. But it is not necessary to imagine the Earth being destroyed like a nova by a stellar explosion to understand vividly the growing scope of atomic war and to recognize that unless another war is prevented, it is likely to bring destruction on a scale never before held possible and even now hardly conceived, and that little civilization would survive it. In the first 2 years of the atomic era, another phenomena is to be noted. The public, having been warned of the horrible nature of atomic warfare, has done nothing about it, and to a large extent has dismissed the warning from its consciousness. A danger that cannot be averted, perhaps better be forgotten, or a danger against which every possible precaution has been taken, also had probably better be forgotten. That is, if the United States had dispersed its industries and decentralized its cities, it might be reasonable for people to forget the peril they face. I should say parenthetically that it is well that this country has not taken those precautions, for to have done so would make atomic war still more probable, since it would convince the rest of the world that we are resigned to it and are preparing for it. But nothing has been done to avert war, while much has been done to make atomic war more horrible. So there is no excuse for ignoring the danger. I say that nothing has been done to avert war since the completion of the atomic bomb, despite the proposal for supranational control of atomic energy put forward by the United States in the United Nations. This country has made only a conditional proposal, and on conditions which the Soviet Union is now determined not to accept. This makes it possible to blame the failure on the Russians. But in blaming Russians, the Americans should not ignore the fact that they themselves have not voluntarily renounced the use of the bomb as an ordinary weapon in the time before the achievement of supranational control. Or, if supranational control is not achieved, thus they have fed the fears of other countries that they consider the bomb a legitimate part of their arsenal, so long as other countries decline to accept their terms for supranational control. Americans may be convinced of their determination not to launch an aggressive or preventive war, so they may believe it is superfluous to announce publicly that they will not a second time be the first to use the atomic bomb. But this country has been solemnly invited to renounce the use of the bomb, that is, to outlaw it, and it has declined to do so unless its terms for supranational control are accepted. I believe this policy is a mistake. I see a certain military gain from not renouncing the use of the bomb in the way that may be deemed to restrain another country from starting a war in which the United States might use it. But what is gained in one way is lost in another. For an understanding over the supranational control of atomic energy has been made more remote. That may be no military drawback so long as the United States has the exclusive use of the bomb. But the moment another country is able to make it in substantial quantities, the United States loses greatly through the absence of an international agreement because of the vulnerability of its concentrated industries and its highly developed urban life. In refusing to outlaw the bomb while having a monopoly on it, this country suffers in another respect, in that it fails to return publicly to the ethical standards of warfare formally accepted previous to the last war. It should not be forgotten that the atomic bomb was made in this country as a preventative measure. It was to head off its use by the Germans if they discovered it. The bombing of civilian centers was initiated by the Germans and adopted by the Japanese. To it, the Allies responded in kind, as it turned out, with greater effectiveness, and they were morally justified in doing so. But now, without any provocation, and without the justification of reprisal or retaliation, a refusal to outlaw the use of the bomb, save in reprisal, is making a political purpose of its possession. This is hardly pardonable. I am not saying that the United States should not manufacture and stockpile the bomb, for I believe that it must do so. It must be able to deter another nation from making an atomic attack when it also has the bomb. But deterrence should be the only purpose of a stockpile of bombs. In the same way, I believe the United States should have the atomic bomb when it is supplied with its own armed forces and weapons. But the United Nations should have the atomic bomb when it is supplied with its own armed forces and weapons. But it too should have the bomb for the sole purpose of deterring an aggressor or rebellious nations from making an atomic attack. It should not use the atomic bomb on its own initiative any more than the United States or any other power should do so. To keep a stockpile of atomic bombs without promising not to initiate its use is exploiting the possession of bombs for political ends. It may be that the United States hopes in this way to frighten the Soviet Union into accepting supranational control of atomic energy. But the creation of fear only heightens antagonism and increases the danger of war. I am of the opinion that this policy has detracted from the very real virtue in the offer of supranational control of atomic energy. We have emerged from a war in which we had to accept the degradingly low ethical standards of the enemy. But instead of feeling liberated from his standards and set free to restore the sanctity of human life and the safety of non-combatants, we are in effect making the low standards of the enemy in the last war our own for the present. Thus, we are starting toward another war degraded by our own choice. It may be that the public is not fully aware that in another war, atomic bombs will be available in large quantities. It may measure the dangers in the terms of the three bombs exploded before the end of the last war. The public also may not appreciate that, in relation to the damage inflicted, atomic bombs already have become the most economical form of destruction that can be used on the offensive. In another war, the bombs will be plentiful, and they will be comparatively cheap. Unless there is determination not to use them that is stronger than can be noted today among American political and military leaders, and on the part of the public itself, atomic warfare will be hard to avoid. Unless Americans come to recognize that they are not stronger in the world because they have the bomb, but weaker because of their vulnerability to atomic attack, they are not likely to conduct their policy at Lake Success or in their relations with Russia in a spirit that furthers the arrival at an understanding. But I do not suggest that the American failure to outlaw the use of the bomb, except in retaliation, is the only cause for the absence of an agreement with the Soviet Union over atomic control. The Russians have made it clear that they will do everything in their power to prevent a supranational regime from coming into existence. They not only reject it in the range of atomic energy, they reject it sharply on principle, and thus have spurned in advance any overture to join a limited world government. Mr. Gromyko has rightly said that the essence of the American atomic proposal is that national sovereignty is not compatible with the atomic era. He declares that the Soviet Union cannot accept this thesis. The reasons he gives are obscure, for they quite obviously are pretexts. But what seems to be true is that the Soviet leaders believe they cannot preserve the social structure of the Soviet state in a supranational regime. The Soviet government is determined to maintain its present social structure, and the leaders of Russia, who hold their great power through the nature of that structure, will spare no effort to prevent a supranational regime from coming into existence, to control atomic energy or anything else. The Russians may be partly right about the difficulty of retaining their present social structure in a supranational regime, though in time they may be brought to see that this is a far less loss than remaining isolated from a world of law. But at present, they appear to be guided by their fears, and one must admit that the United States has made ample contributions to these fears, not only as to atomic energy, but in many other respects. Indeed, this country has conducted its Russian policy as though it were convinced that fear is the greatest of all diplomatic instruments. That the Russians are striving to prevent the formation of a supranational security system is no reason why the rest of the world should not work to create one. It has been pointed out that the Russians have a way of resisting with all their arts what they do not wish to have happen, but once it happens, they can be flexible and accommodate themselves to it. So it would be well for the United States and other powers not to permit the Russians to veto an attempt to create supranational security. They can proceed with some hope that once the Russians see, they cannot prevent such a regime, that they may join it. So far, the United States has shown no interest in preserving the security of the Soviet Union. It has been interested in its own security, which is characteristic of the competition, which marks the conflict for power between sovereign nation states. But one cannot know in advance what would be the effect on Russian fears if the American people forced their leaders to pursue a policy of substituting law for the president for the present anarchy of international relations. In a world of law, Russian security would be equal to our own, and for the American people to espouse this wholeheartedly, something that should be possible under the workings of democracy, might work a kind of miracle in Russian thinking. At present, the Russians have no evidence to convince them that the American people are not contentedly supporting a policy of military preparedness, which they regard as a policy of deliberate intimidation. If they had evidences of a passionate desire by Americans to preserve peace in the one way that it can be maintained by a supranational regime of law, this would upset Russian calculations about the peril to Russian security in current trends of American thought. Not until a genuine, convincing offer is made to the Soviet Union, backed by an aroused American public, will one be entitled to say what the Russian response would be. It may be the first response would be to reject the world of law. But if from that moment it began to be clear to the Russians that such a world was coming into existence without them, and that their own security was being increased, their ideas necessarily would change. I am in favor of inviting the Russians to join a world government authorized to provide security, and if they are unwilling to join, to proceed to establish supranational security without them. Let me admit quickly that I see great peril in such a course. If it is adopted, it must be done in a way to make it utterly clear that the new regime is not a combination of power against Russia. It must be a combination that, by its composite nature, will greatly reduce the chances of war. It will be more diverse in its interests than any single state, thus less likely to resort to aggressive or preventive war. It will be much larger, hence stronger than any single nation. It will be geographically much more extensive, and thus more difficult to defeat by military means. It will be dedicated to supranational security, and thus escape the emphasis on national supremacy, which is so strong a factor in war. If a supranational regime is set up without Russia, its service to peace will depend on the skill and sincerity with which it is done. Emphasis should always be apparent on the desire to have Russia take part. It must be clear to Russia, and no less so to the nations comprising the organization, that no penalty is incurred or implied because a nation declines to join. If the Russians do not join at the onset, they must be sure of a welcome when they do decide to join. Those who create the organization must understand that they are building with the final objective of obtaining Russian adherence. These are abstractions, and it is not easy to outline the specific lines a partial world government must follow to induce the Russians to join. But two conditions are clear to me. The new organization must have no military secrets, and the Russians must be free to have observers at every session of the organization, where its new laws are drafted, discussed, and adopted, and where its policies are decided. That would destroy the great factory of secrecy where so many of the world's suspicions are manufactured. It may affront the military-minded person to suggest a regime that does not maintain any military secrets. He has been taught to believe that secrets thus divulged would enable a war-minded nation to seek to conquer the earth. I grant that there is a risk in not maintaining military secrets. If a sufficient number of nations have pooled their strength, they can take this risk, for their security will be greatly increased. And it can be done with greater assurance because of the decrease of fear, suspicion, and distrust that will result. The tensions of the increasing likelihood of war in a world based on sovereignty would be replaced by the relaxation of the growing confidence in peace. In time, this might so allure the Russian people that their leaders would mellow in their attitude toward the West. I should like to see the authority of a supranational regime restricted altogether to the field of security. Whether this would be possible, I am not sure. Experience may point to the desirability of adding some authority over economic matters, since under modern conditions, these are capable of causing national upsets that have in them the seeds of violent conflict. But I should prefer to see the function of the organization altogether limited to the tasks of security. I also should like to see this regime established through the strengthening of the United Nations, so as to not sacrifice continuity in the search for peace. I do not hide from myself the great difficulties of establishing a world government, either a beginning without Russia or one with Russia. I am aware of the risks, since I should not wish it to be permissible for any country that has joined the supranational organization to secede. One of these risks would be possible civil war. But I also believe the world government is certain to come in time, and that the question of how much it is to be permitted to cost. It will come, I believe, even if there is another world war, though after such a war, if it is won, it would be world government established by the victor. But I also believe that it can come through agreement and through the force of persuasion alone, hence low cost. But if it is to come in this way, it will not be enough to appeal to reason. One strength of the communist system of the East is that it has some of the character of a religion, and it inspires the emotions of a religion. Unless the cause of peace based on law gathers behind it the force and zeal of a religion, it hardly can hope to succeed. Those to whom the moral teaching of the human race is entrusted surely have a great duty and a great opportunity. The atomic scientists, I think, have become convinced that they cannot arouse the American people to the truths of the atomic era by logic alone. There must be added that deep power of emotion, which is a basic ingredient of religion. It is to be hoped that not only the churches, but the schools, the colleges, and the leading organs of opinion will acquit themselves well of their unique responsibility in this regard. Albert Einstein was a theoretical physicist best known for his mass energy equivalence formula, E equals mc squared, and his development of the theory of relativity. He was awarded the 1921 Nobel Prize in Physics for his contributions to the field. This was a very long article, and it was edited somewhat for time. Our second story, dismantling the Department of Education without saying why. The American people deserve to know the court's reasoning. And this was written by Quinta Jurisic. The Supreme Court is allowing Donald Trump to dismantle the Department of Education, but it won't say why. Recently, almost exactly a week after the court lifted a lower court's block on Trump's plan to fire thousands of federal employees, a majority of the justices decided to give the president the go-ahead for a different set of mass layoffs. Last week, the court provided a handful of sentences that vaguely gestured at why it might have allowed the administration to move forward. This week, it offered nothing at all. There's something taunting, almost bullying, about this lack of reasoning, as if the conservative supermajority is saying to the country, you don't even deserve an explanation. Whereas last week's case involved orders to lay off employees from across the entire federal government, this week's involves just the Education Department. Over the course of his 2024 campaign and in the first few months of his second term, Trump repeatedly announced his plans to close the agency. The department was, quote, a big con job, end quote, he told reporters in February, and he would like to close it immediately. In March, Education Secretary Linda McMahon announced plans to cut the department's workforce in half. Trump followed up with that executive with an executive order mandating that McMahon take all necessary steps to facilitate the closure of the Department of Education. There was one minor problem with this plan. The executive branch, at least theoretically, did not have the unilateral authority to abolish the Education Department, which was created by an act of Congress in 1979. A coalition of states, school districts, and unions sued, and a federal district court temporarily blocked the administration from moving forward. That court order required the department to rehire employees already laid off, pointing to both the Constitution and a statutory prohibition against arbitrary and capricious actions by federal agencies. In that lower court, the government argued that it sought only to improve the efficiency and accountability of the department through reorganization. But District Judge Nyong J. Jun was unconvinced. A department without enough employees to perform statutorily mandated functions is not a department at all, he wrote. An appeals court upheld Jun's ruling, freezing Trump's plans while the district court continued to weigh the underlying legal questions. At this point, stop me if you've heard this one before, the Supreme Court stepped in. Despite a frustrated dissent from the court's three liberal justices, the majority's unsigned emergency ruling allowed Trump to carry out his plans while the litigation in the lower courts continues. The majority is either willfully blind to the implications of its ruling or naive, Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote. But either way, the threat to our Constitution's separations of powers is grave. She went on, the president must take care of the laws that the laws are faithfully executed, not set out to dismantle them. The odd protocol of the court's emergency docket, sometimes called the shadow docket, means that the underlying question of whether Trump has the legal authority to tear apart the Education Department remains unresolved, even as a majority of the justices have allowed him to carry out his plans. Courts, even the Supreme Court, could still find the department's dismantling illegal down the road. But in the meantime, the agency will have been devastated, perhaps irreparably. Layoffs will dramatically reduce the staffing of the already worked Office of Civil Rights, which is responsible for ensuring equal access to education, including for disabled students. The administration will eviscerate the office responsible for helping students with financial aid for higher education. The government has said that this position of the agency's portfolio will be shifted over to the Treasury Department. But what this will look like in practice is unclear. The cuts will almost erase the Institute of Education Science, which publishes authoritative data on American schools and has already missed key deadlines this year. Given the potentially devastating effects on the Supreme Court's ruling on congressionally mandated programs, it's all the more galling that the majority didn't bother to provide even a cursory explanation of its thinking. This terseness has become common as the court has scaled up its use of emergency rulings. Rulings that, it's hard not to notice, have a striking tendency to align with the Trump administration's priorities. Stephen I. Vladeck, a law professor at Georgetown University and an authority on the shadow docket, tallied the Education Department order as the 15th since early April in which the court has granted Trump emergency relief, and the 7th in which justices have provided not a word of explanation. Do the conservative justices feel that the president really does have the legal authority to destroy a cabinet department on his own? Or perhaps they believe that the plaintiffs lack the ability to bring the case at all in federal court? Maybe the reason was something else altogether. There's no way to know. This is part of what distinguishes law from the raw exercise of power and what anchors the courts as a component of a democratic system rather than setting them apart as unaccountable sages. With a written opinion, people can evaluate the justices' reasoning for themselves. Without it, they are left to puzzle over the court's thinking, like ancients struggling to decipher the wrath of gods in the scattering of entrails. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org.